Thanks for attending session 164, titled Faith Crisis as Disorienting Dilemma, Road to Transformation. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor, just out this door and to the right. We encourage you also to purchase other Sunstone merchandise or to make a donation to Sunstone to help support these amazing events. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework. A little about this presentation. As greater numbers of believers suffer a faith crisis, better tools are needed to help with understanding and recovery. Mesereau's 10 Phases of Transformative Learning, an adult learning theory, can assist in alleviating pain by guiding reflection and an exploration of new possibilities. Indeed, with a healthy process of acquiring new knowledge, identity, and relationships, transformation can be transcendent. Dr. Paul Sparks currently directs the Learning Technologies and is former chair of award-winning MA in Learning Technology at Pepperdine University. He leads courses in learning theory, social media, and design, and guides delegations to Washington, D.C., Singapore, and Dubai for global perspectives and policy. Past lives include aerospace, internet startups, and K-12 math. His work includes participatory media, identity and informal learning, and pastimes of mountain biking and interactive art. And I'll turn the time over to him.
Thank you very much. So I got to say right off the bat, I'm used to doctoral students. You guys scare the heck out of me. Not sure where you're all coming from, but we'll get into that in a second. Faith crisis, let's go. So I love Hawaii. I get to go every once in a while, and this, it's on the screen, but anyone know what aloha means? Alo is presence, ha is breath. We're all present together with breath, right? In the same space. Humans have a strange way of doing non-human things, and we can get them to even do more non-human things. It seems to be easy, but I'm going to try that right now just to get a feel for the audience. And so I'm going to ask you to take a deep breath and hold it. And now let the breath out through your left nostril only. One more try. Deep breath. And out through the right nostril only. All right. We got a good group today. You'd be surprised how in a doctoral class, not a single person will use a finger. It's a little scary. A little scary. Secondly, I got a picture of a brain. We're going to be talking about brains a little bit. It's a little bit of a side hobby for me. Just I live close to UCI, and they have one of the major neuro research centers on neurobiology. It's fascinating. Fascinating. So you might know this already. I'm not really... No, I can't say that right now because you'll prejudge me. But not really a dog person. I know. But all mammals check in with each other. They have this thing, it's a thing called limbic resonance. I found it first in a book called A General Theory of Love, which is a great read. And it turns out that you've got the reptilian brain, which is this little red part, just a little stub, then the mammalian brain, which contains all of the amygdala and the hypothalamus and all of those little organs that deal with emotion. So we've got an emotional brain. In fact, a guy named Minsky wrote a book called The Emotion Machine. It's basically what the brain does. So mammals have that as well to greater or larger extent. And so mammals will always check in with each other and always seem to connect on an emotional level. I think way more than actual humans do on a regular basis, right? So I'm going to ask you just to kind of warm up the crowd. If you'd all stand up and find a partner, somebody, it can be two, three people all together. This is just a little warm-up, get-to-know-you exercise, acknowledge other humans in the room. We're mammals. I don't want to break it to you, but we're mammals. So, if you would please stand aside from each other and look into each other's eyes directly. All right, you got it? You do. No groups of five or more, or just three or more. You two guys are going to have to go together right here. Yeah. All right. Now let's look into each other's eyes. I give that lovely person across from you a little wink. All right. Now let's take a step closer, a little step closer. You guys are married. That's not fair. All right. Now look back in their eyes and hold the gaze. Now lick your lips. And give that beautiful person, that beautiful mammal in front of you, a big giant high five. All right, you can sit back down. A few people got hugs. You're welcome. Now, since this is true, some of you actually have pets at home, a dog that's kind of bummed out that you're at Sunstone and they're locked up in the house, right? Anybody? Yeah? You going to make it up to them? So we're talking about the limbic system and limbic resonance. This is, happens with mammals. Now, I also want to get some good context going here, so if you'll pay attention to the screen. We do kind of get wrapped up in ourselves, don't we?
Make sure the mic is getting you, okay?
Oh, okay. So we're here today to talk about, what was it again? That universe got in the way. Oh, yeah. Faith crisis, right? Which is real. I know it's real, and it hurts a lot. But look at the universe. Isn't it amazing? We're on a little tiny planet in a little tiny solar system, a little tiny galaxy in a big giant universe. And lately, they keep finding stuff out, right? We thought this was all static. They're finding out that Hubble's constant is different in all parts in different places in the universe. In some places, it seems to be expanding faster than other places. It's pretty crazy. So I am your humble guide today, and this is me having a faith crisis with my doctoral students. If you can see that picture, they do. I think it might have been when they wouldn't use their fingers to breathe out. This is just so you get to know me a little bit better. I've been through all the education stuff. Was a teacher. I enjoyed that a lot. Worked in aerospace, internet, and raised LDS. Mission, all that stuff, but I feel like I've had a lifelong faith crisis, and I've gone on this quest to figure things out. And learning theory, and so my profession is learning technology and learning theory. How do we learn stuff? What do we know? How do we know it? Do we really know it? All of that sort of stuff. The stuff that makes my father just crazy. But I hope it will be meaningful to you. My father just turned 90, by the way. I've been waiting to do Sunstone, thinking that he might pass on. He wouldn't approve. But I just turned 65. He just turned 90. I had to go for it. Now, in the spirit of the current debate, I'd like to get a feel for where you guys are. So I'm going to ask a few questions. I made some assumptions when I put the presentation together that there's going to be a certain amount of faith crisis happening in the room. Could you show me, like, Buttigieg and... All right, good. That's what I was expecting. Perfect. What about you want to be understood? A full Bernie. Ways to heal relationships. All right. Don't feel bad. This is okay, too. Replace lost community? Yeah. All right. I'm with you. 100%. Want some transformation in your life? Like to get past all of this somehow? Yes, you're in the right place. But I got bad news about feeling pain and disorientation. You feel that too? All right. Some good pain in the back. So here's the bad news. I have been to the mountain. I like to go around, it's a little hobby of mine, to go around to the different meetup groups and see what's happening. And from Arizona to, you know, Nevada, Utah, I guess that's not a huge area, but everyone says they feel ghosted. One guy came up with ghosted, and I didn't even know what that was. He says, they just act like you're a ghost, you know, they just kind of, you're sort of there, but not really. And shunned and lost friends. And here's something, I've dealt with that as well, because I've really wanted my father to understand where I'm at and that I still love him, all of that, right? But a big part of the pain comes from the desire to be understood and accepted, I think. You just want people to understand where you're at. You're not crazy. You're not trying to be bad. This is just where your mind went, right? And your soul and your spirit. So the bad news, that's a natural part of life. So, but I would challenge you and say, hasn't it always been a part of your life? Weren't you married before and they never understood who you were? Didn't you have friends that didn't really get you? So it might be asking a little too much of life in the first place, right? That these people that now you've parted ways with will understand it somehow. So just relax on the gotta understand me thing. That's my advice. You have no control over it anyway, so just let it go. It's probably not going to happen. I've been to the mountain, like I said. I asked these sadhus in the Himalayas, and you know what they said to me? Let it go. And that'll be $5 for the photo. True story. So, our agenda today is to explore faith and faith crisis, apply some key learning tech theories. If I get a little too academic and boring, just, you know, you can use the same signal disco. I want to try and reframe faith and crisis and pain, and maybe that will help. And then discuss the future of faith, and then get to any questions you might have. Okay. So what is faith? Faith, you've heard this before, is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not yet seen. Can someone explain that to me? That it ever made sense to you at all?
I've read several commentaries on it. I've got a few ideas.
Yeah. It's what we call in academia word salad. There's words there. But when you read it, and you read it 10 times, it still doesn't make sense. Word salad. I realize I'm contradicting scripture, but I've got a lightning rod, so. I think there's better explanations for faith. My son, I was a little worried about the presentation, so we went up to hear bluegrass at the Natural History Museum. Nothing will settle your nerves like hanging out with dinosaur bones listening to bluegrass music. It was nice. But Jeff Hawkins is a crazy neurobiologist who's kind of bucked the regular neurobiology folks. And he's doing research in Northern California that suggests that there are these columns in the neocortex. That's the part above the mammalian brain that's just like 2 centimeters thick, and it covers the whole brain and it's convoluted. It says there are these cortical columns that appear to be kind of self-sufficient. And his current theory is that each one of the columns contains its own little model of the world from different perspectives, like from a sound perspective or a vision perspective or a I gotta get there perspective. So, and it's constantly getting input, like, hey, there's something red over here, and hey, it's wet over here, And it's constantly getting input and constantly predicting what's going to happen in the future. He calls it a prediction machine. Does that sound like faith a little bit? That you're looking for something to happen and you're pretty confident that's going to happen? Anyway, here's a quick little brain experiment. I want one half. I'm not sure this is going to work because I'm not sure you're... Well, we'll give it a try. Could this side of the room close your eyes, please, for just a moment? Hang on to your valuables. The other side of the room is going to see something, and then when I say go, I would like for everybody to start yelling out names of characters, okay? Ready, set, keep your eyes closed, go! All right, come on. Left side of the room. Oh, open your eyes. I kind of blew that. The other side of the room was ready to go because they were looking at the picture already, right? I asked you to open your eyes a little too late. I apologize for that. But the idea here is that the image was firing up your cortical columns, and it's going, I know what we're talking about. We're talking about Game of Thrones because I see the pictures, right? So when I ask you to say the names, they just start flying out. These guys on the other side were seeing it a little late and didn't have that warm-up period, right? Does that make sense? Any questions? Yeah. So a couple of takeaways on faith. Sensory input is always activating our mental models, which expect and predict likely outcomes. It's an expectation engine. The neocortex is always in a state of faith. And if you're 1 year old, you don't have a lot of faith that the sun's going to come up the next morning. But if you're 1 year old, you do. And if you're 65 years old, that's been happening your whole life. So your brain is going, yeah, it's going to happen 100%. So there's interesting things what happened from that and what religion has become. But anyway, but what if the sun doesn't shine the next day? We got a problem, right? Because your brain's expecting it to, and it doesn't. Here's another quick little experiment. What do you see there in the picture? Upside down woman. Is she happy? I put there to help us out. Pretty good chance it's an upside down happy girl. But when we spin it around, something's going to happen. Same image spun around. What just happened? That a little creepy? Should we do it again? And she's pretty happy. Happy eyes, big smile, blonde hair. Oh! I did this with Marie Osmond too, and I just didn't think it would be fair. With this audience. She's been through a lot, right? So what's going on here? We've got little modules in the brain, probably a couple of those columns, that are looking for smiles, looking for happy eyes. And they're going, hey, we got smiles, we got happy eyes. We got a head, a blonde head of a girl. Happy eyes, smile, blonde head of a girl, everything's cool. But when you turn it around in that context, it doesn't make sense, right? That's an expectation failure. All right? So I got a picture of a robot failure. Has this ever happened to you? We'll watch it a couple of times. It looks like he's going to get the wheel, right? But he misses. Has that ever happened to you? You're going down the stairs and there's like one too many or one too few. That's an expectation failure. So what happens to your brain? Is that your, like, your faith, your spirituality is out of whack? No, it's just your model of the world needs to be, you know, improved. Maybe somebody came along and put an extra step in. I have, what's coming up next is kind of special. I have a video of a robot trying to get something on his shelf, and it doesn't work. You're all familiar with the shelf language in faith crisis. So here's a robot trying to put something, the last thing he could possibly get on his shelf, and disaster happens. I know it's going to fit. It's got to work. I've been doing this my whole life. All right. So what you have just witnessed is a robot faith crisis. Can't get it on the shelf, and so just like takes a dive. So this is funny for robots, but not for humans, right? Because we're doing that all the time. I mean, we've probably been doing that for long periods of our lives, trying to get it up on the shelf. It's got to fit somehow. So these little mini expectation failures are kind of like a little mini faith crisis, right? I mean, if you're going to come along with me on this journey. So let's try a few things. Here are a few others. Did the tooth fairy ever forget your seventh tooth? It's like, it's under there. I put it under the pillow, Mom, Dad, and it's still there. Yeah, anybody walked into a glass door recently? Yeah. We're glad that you're able to make it with us. You didn't get the raise you deserve? Ouch. Someone you trust lies to you? That hurts. So, but what I'm saying is these are kind of inaccurate models and should be fine-tuned. You're at a whole different level when you've got stuff like this going on, and please sit down. You know, an organization misrepresents its history or refutes scientific issues. Key teachings are abandoned without explanation, or in instituting feminist LGBTQ inequities. That sort of thing is pretty big, and if you've built your whole life around the opposite, it hurts. It physically hurts because it's a physical thing. That cortical column in your brain is a physical thing, and neurons have arranged themselves to represent that. And when it goes away or turns out to not be true, it's physically painful. It's kind of like this. That only took me 3 hours searching on the internet. It feels like someone took a flaming hammer to your melon, right? You've been there. And one other, please forgive me for this one. It puts gaslighting in a completely different light. It almost makes it worse. If after that sort of faith crisis, someone else also comes along and says, well, no, you should doubt your doubts. I think intentional fake news is gaslighting. And teaching someone to distrust themselves is very, very, very wrong. It's very wrong on a whole lot of levels. And from a neurobiological level, I hope you can see that. It's how are you going to get a solid model of the world if you can't trust what your brain is doing? So, I dug us into a pretty deep hole. I got to get us out. So we get to take the students to different places, and one was Boston, and there's a guy, Ben Zander, who was the conductor of the Boston Philharmonic. He would say to all of this, how fascinating. We've got to create some possibility around this. So let's create some possibility. And We'll see how this goes. I'd like for you to pretend with me that it's 2 to 3 years into the future. You're at a party. We're all at a party. You get to pick your drink or your beverage, right? I'm going to start up the music here. Oh, we moved on to Margaritaville, apparently. Maybe that's better than Boston, anyway. Okay, so you're at the party, mill around, lean over to talk to somebody and say, tell them what it's like, what life is like now that you've gotten past your faith crisis. Who do you hang out with? Describe your relationships with your family members, your spouse, your old friends, new friends, church members, etc. Have fun. You got 2 or 3 minutes. Remember, this is 2 or 3 years in the future. You've lived through your faith crisis. This is what life is like now. Margaritaville. It's your future, your imagination. Make it fun. Okay, you're not working hard enough. We're going to have to up the music. One more minute. Let's throw some extra juice. That's good inventing them. Inventing the future music, isn't it? All right, you got something fun in mind? Anyone want to share? Okay, that's right. I hope it's a good future. We're going to try to make that happen. But we got to move on to what I was supposed to talk about. Learning theories. This is a buddy of mine at Pepperdine. He's Lou Cozzolino, and he writes like a book and a half a year. He's a machine, and it's all about the brain is an emotional organ, and he applies that to psychology and education. He's written a book called Neuroscience of Education. I got to have a quick early look at it, and it's all about this. It's that the brain is a social emotional organ. Relationships and exploration grow the brain. Stress and bullying stunt the brain. If you're a teacher or an educator or know somebody, you kind of know that already. So here's the first guy. We're gonna look at three learning theories, and I'm gonna try to make sure that this has some meaning to you. So this guy Mesereau, this goes way back to like the 60s. He started studying women who were going back to college and found out that they didn't just learn a little extra stuff, started started, you know, doing housework better or whatever else, they like totally changed where they were coming from. They totally changed their worldview. It was a transformational education. Right? So he studied that. He said, that's really interesting. We want to see what's going on. For these women, they come for a little extra education and you know, completely change their worldview. That's exciting. That's interesting. So he documented that process of transformation, and it's now called the Transformational Learning Theory. And I'm going to walk you through it here real quick, and I would like you to participate by just kind of, you don't have to raise your hands, but it's just, yeah, that's happened to me, or not so much. At some point during the 10 steps, you're probably going to veer off, and it's like, I didn't do that. So first of all, you experienced a disorienting dilemma. We've got a lot of words for this, right? It's like Eskimos and snow, because it's a big part of our life. Expectation failure, disorienting dilemma now, right? So, yeah? Did you do a self-examination? Or you had a self-examination with feelings of guilt and shame? This isn't an LDS guy, by the way, right? This is... Did you critically assess your assumptions? Epistemic means, you know, what you know and how you know it. And cultural, did you assess your cultural assumptions? Did you recognize that the discontent and change is shared by many people? That was harder back in the 70s when I was doing some of this. I felt like I was the only person alive. Did you explore options for new roles? This is where people start to veer off, right? It's like, everything's making me lean that way, but I gotta stay. Did you actually do a plan, a course of action? It's like, all right, I gotta deal with this. We gotta make some plans. Did you go out and acquire new knowledge? Again, this is totally non-church related, right? This transformational learning theory. But it seems to fit so well. Did you try out new roles? Just try on a new identity. Hey, I'm going to be, I don't know, party girl for a little while and see how that works for me. Didn't work so well for me. Did you build competence and self-confidence in new roles and relationships? Maybe you're still in that process. And then reintegrate that into your life. So that's the transformational learning theory. So if you didn't know that was happening, or if you're just at the stage of a disorienting dilemma, you can see how this might be helpful, right? It's like, oh, here's a list of all the stuff I can do to get through and transform. So right away, if you know somebody that's at the first stages, you can give them this list, tell them to look up Mesereau, and away you go. Well, one of my dissertation students, she just finished, and she's very, very happy there. Tanya Insine decided to take this a little bit further, and she went out and read all the studies she could find on disorienting dilemmas, and she read hundreds of these large articles, and she found that there were various contexts for disorientation. One was study abroad, international service, right? Going outside of the country. We've probably, many of us, done that, and that does kind of get your attention. Human development, professional development, dealing with a career change, dealing with death, race, class, and gender experiences, right? Those are all kind of big things that could be lumped into transformational. But interestingly enough, not any. She said one kind of talked about religious and faith crisis, but not so much. So I found that to be pretty interesting. She went through and kind of revamped that 10-item list to be a little more friendly, and added the piece down here, which is the disorientation index. Let me go through that in a minute here. And you see this a little more friendly. So you get disoriented, you have some critical reflection, you learn some stuff, and you integrate that in your life, and you go ahead. This is very close to, if anyone's a big fan of Hero's Journey or Plato's cave, that sort of thing. It's like a cycle. That can happen over and over again in your life. So you can tell she did an awful lot of work and worked out these eight factors for disorientation. And then she wrote up a whole list on, here's the factor, what does that entail, what are some suggestions you could do in that situation. So rather than have you read that, I pulled out a few and would just ask you to kind of see if it makes sense to you. So is the experience being perceived as negative or non-negative? Is it negative or positive? Right? So for you, you'd say one or the other. Is this disorientation taking place in an educational setting? Yes or no? Education, interestingly enough, as Maslow found out, is a big transformation. It's a big disorienting experience for a lot of people. Seclusion. Is more than one person experiencing the disorienting event? You can kind of start to sense where she's going with this, because if you got a whole bunch of people that experienced, I don't know, a flying saucer landing in the backyard, then you can handle that together possibly in different ways. And locus of control. Did the individual choose the experience, or was it thrust upon them? Right? So we're not going to go through all of those, but when you pull it all together, you've got these eight different factors, and she's made it visual here. So this is the most common one, where it's the experience was voluntary but negative, and they had no prior experience. It happened to them alone in a familiar location, right? And was externally generated in the rest. So now everybody's going to have a slightly different approach, and I'm bringing in one of our guest speakers here. One of our guests is Tara Westover. Read the book? Educated? Okay, fair number. Fantastic book. It's a transformation into selfhood, right? And I'm going to go out on a limb, a bit of a faith crisis as well, right? Or disorienting dilemma. So I took the liberty to map out Tara's, and it looks like this. So in the future, it won't be just, hey, I had a disorienting experience. It'll be, what was the flavor of your disorienting experience? We can help you based on this little map. Got it? So we're working on building something there. I'm thinking a kind of a Myers-Briggs meets Game of Thrones meets World of Warcraft sort of game, where you can fix yourself online. Fix yourself is totally the wrong language. Have a little fun with your faith crisis online and come out the other end singing Margaritaville. Learning theory number two. Communities of practice. You're all members of communities, I'm guessing. We're emotional creatures. We're social creatures. We like to hang out in groups, right? So this helps us understand the nature of knowledge. Is knowledge something that you can stuff in your head, or is knowledge something that your community knows? I get in trouble with our accrediting board because I said, you're making this stuff, all this stuff, in individual brains, when knowledge is really stored in communities. How are you going to measure that? Ah! And I was released from the committee. So let's talk about communities of practice. You're members of probably multiple communities of practice. It's just new language. Theories don't invent reality. Theories try to kind of parse out reality, what's going on. So people like to hang out in groups. People go to work. People go to church. People get into the Boy Scouts. So what's going on exactly? So in a community of practice, you've got all these levels. You've got people that are just lurking on the sides, right? And you got people that are like the core group. So any one person can come upon a community of practice and say, hey, this looks a little interesting, but if they get the cold shoulder, or if they find out they're really not interested, they just zip on through, right? But you can also say, wow, I love these people, I'm going to hang out. And these are dynamic structures, within a couple of years, they're in charge, right? They're the president. That's happened to you. Rotary Club? Something like that. But in the inverse way, people who were like running the show and in charge and the total experts, they can transition out because they no longer want to be there. So that's how communities of practice work. The thing with communities of practice is you've got to understand that it's an actual practice. You're actually trying to do something. And you've got a community that's there. It's easy to learn in a community practice because the best person to learn something from is a person who just learned it themselves, not from the experts. And when you're in a community, they're going to make sure that you learn it because otherwise the community looks bad. So when you're learning in a community, it's effortless and expected, and it just happens. And we're trying to use that more in education. I've proposed that several times. We're not there yet. It also gives you a sense of identity. When you ask a person who they are, they'll tell you all the groups they're a part of, right? You get a huge sense of identity from your practice. So all of you have different, many communities of practice. I think we're going to skip this next little exercise because we're running out of time, but you've got family and friends, right? This look familiar, church. Oh, we got two families. Oops. That was with the last group. Oh, hey, I don't know. It might fit with this group. So I was going to have you just imagine your past community landscape. You've got family, friends, people you used to hang out with. And if you're in transition, that's probably changing, right? So some of those groups maybe not so much now. Some of those groups maybe coming on board a little bit. The point here with community of practice is it's very, very complicated. These communities sometimes interact with each other, and now you've got a whole layer on the outside of technology that allows you to communicate in even more fantastic ways. But if something happens, you have a transformation or a faith crisis, and you blow up some of your communities, what happens? That hurts too, right? Your identity is severely impacted. You can't say I'm a member of this and that and the other anymore, necessarily, right? Your family could even disown you or your friends. And there you are, sitting there with just one little work community and having no fun at all. So what do we do? Etienne Wenger, who came up with this model, is very fond of saying, you change your modality, you change, it's a landscape of possibilities. If we could see communities of practice, they would stretch out infinitely into the future. All you got to do is walk up to them and see if they'll accept you and see if you'll accept them. You can become a part of any group going forward, right? This is a play in a different sandbox sort of stuff. I don't want to play here anymore. I'm going to go play in a different sandbox. You show up and start playing, and if they let you, then you're a member of that community. So I'd like to invite you, if that's all happening with you, there's meetup groups. There's all kinds of fun stuff to be a part of. And if you have to change out your communities, It's really better. Let's see, where's my takeaways? It's really the best advice to maintain your communities of practice, but if that's not possible or no longer a happy place, then diversify. There's a zillion of them out there. Make sense? And there's this idea that learning equals managing your identity. So we tell that to our students all the time. They decide to show up for a doctoral program. They've managed their identity, and they're going to learn something a lot different than if they didn't, right? And you're going to be doing the same depending on what, you know, go fly model airplanes. You're going to learn a whole lot of stuff that you didn't know. You just got to decide where you're going to go, and the learning comes afterwards. So last theory. You're starting to glaze over, huh? And this is probably the worst one, but we'll run through it. Activity theory. Learning happens in a complex cultural historical context. They also call it CHAT, cultural historical activity theory. This was invented by a Russian who says when you're trying to get from point A to B, you're trying to teach somebody something, right? You can't just assume that's going to happen. There's a lot of stuff going on. This is what happens in education all the time. It's like, oh, everybody needs to know how to be ethical? Good. We'll come up with a 1 hour little training, and we'll run it in the auditorium because we get 5,000 people in there, and we'll just run them through the hour, and at the end they're gonna all be ethical. It doesn't happen that way. There's a lot of other stuff going on, and that's all he's trying to get across. This is Jero Engström, and I've used some of his slides. So, at the very first level, you've got to understand what tool you're using. So if you're trying to use computers or language or mathematics or whatever to get the point across, that can be problematic. But it's worse than that. All these little triangles that you can see down here, you've got to keep in mind what are the rules? What are the laws? What's the community think, right? Of the subject. That's just of the subject, the person, not necessarily the activity. You might have to look at the activity from the community's point of view, right? Is what we're trying to do what the community wants to do? And so onward and onward, activity theory kind of spirals down into a whole lot of detail. So the takeaways from activity theory. You can look at all of that and you can look at the complexity and you can try and tackle that and get people trained and get them to another place, but it's hard work. And at the end of the day, culture eats strategy for lunch. that's a business term, right? So organizational change is trying to happen all the time. It's ineffective 80% of the time. Education is ineffective 80% of the time. Culture eats strategy for lunch. Unless you're going to deal directly and substantively with culture, it's not going to happen. So if you want to go try to change all your friends and make them see your point of view, you want to train them, you want to teach them the real way the things work, you got a real task ahead of you, and I would say don't bother. You're going to just be frustrated. That's the takeaway. All right, some final thoughts about faith. If you look at Yale and Harvard Divinity Schools and the Pew research, they show huge declines in religiosity, right? Faith, some people call that. Good news is Kurzweil predicts the singularity is going to happen in 2029. If you're not sure what that is, go talk to the transhumanists. We're all going to be replaced with robots in 10 years. That's Ray Kurzweil's very good estimate. And we've seen how well that turns out, right? In the previous video. So what's going to happen in the future? Human brains will continue to be prediction machines, right? But we're going to have access to better information, aren't we? Better models? Hopefully. But if faith is pre-programmed, if it's about do what we say, don't trust yourself, then we've seen the future, and that was that robot fail, the video. All right. Has anyone seen Free Solo? No, Alex Honnold? Do you know Alex? Oh, no, you've seen the movie? My son did his master's thesis on, he went and hung out with these guys. He's a bit of a rock climber himself, and he wanted to find out why they do this. Are they crazy? Everyone thinks they're crazy. You all think they're crazy, climbing on this rock. None of them think they're crazy. It's just the next challenge for themselves. They've got themselves so finely tuned, their brains so finely tuned, they know they can do it. Alex knew he could do it. He wouldn't have gone up there if he knew he was going to fall to his death, right? Doesn't make any sense. So when you fine-tune your brain, your neocortex, to watch for stuff and know for stuff, and you have faith in, I mean, that model of the world allows you to do that sort of thing, you can. So here's a few parting thoughts, and then I think we still have a few minutes for questions. Life is a wonder. And I would like to say this kind of comes a little more personally for me, because I've been struggling with this too, and I can't seem to like ever let it go. So hopefully you don't get in that little cycle. But it's fascinating to me. It's become more of a project that it's fascinating to me what kind of situations humans get themselves into and how we can ameliorate that. So, number one, life is a wonder. Honor the spirit. Watch the stars. Be awestruck. All of that. Our brains will keep doing what they do. They've been doing it for thousands of years, possibly millions of years, right? You go to the Natural History Museum, there are skulls that look like ours that were hundreds of thousands of years ago. What were those guys thinking about? Expectation failure is learning, because you get a better model, right? Even though it hurts, you get a better model. Learning theories and neurobiology helps us understand. And a faith crisis is painful, but look at what you get. You maybe heard that in the context of divorce, right? If you haven't, it's okay. Divorce is expensive, but look at what you get. Faith crisis is painful, but look at what you get. I would encourage everyone, and I'm trying myself, to drop the desire to change others and be understood. Probably not going to happen. Just build community on the other side. Go build out those communities of practice on the other side. There's thousands of them, and you'll be much happier finding the places where you feel welcome. And invite your loved ones to join you in the wonder and possibility. If they do, fantastic. If they don't, you can't change that. So, questions and comment time. We have. We had about 5 minutes. You guys are paying a lot for this. Not as much as the doctoral students, but you might as well get your money's worth.
So when you use the phrase, the desire to be understood, you're meaning to be understood by certain people.
Yeah.
Because if you're not understood by those people, you go on to build the community in other places, find places where you are. I mean, the desire to be understood, you can't abandon by somebody.
Touche. That's a good point. You want to be understood by somebody, but I'm speaking about those people who...
That you may have to drop.
That you may have to drop. They're just not going to get why you left, or you have questions, or, yeah, they're not going to get that.
And so, somebody will.
But somebody will. Oh, yeah. Somebody will. The whole rest of the world will. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, think about it like a little girl.
Because we're recording this, can you repeat the...
Oh, yes.
The
I think she said, so the presentation was trying to redefine faith as fine-tuning your brain so that you're more confident. I think that comes close. And I mean, that's encapsulated in what I was trying to do. If you have a little girl who jumps into her father's arms, right? She's done this 100 times. Does she have faith, unwavering blind faith? No, because she's already jumped into her father's arms 100 times and hasn't dropped her. But to ask some kid that's not their father jump into his arms, they're going to have a little problem with that. And you could say all day, you need to have a little more faith, but that. This doesn't compute, right? It doesn't make any sense. He could have more faith and jump and get squashed. His brain knows better than to do that. Other questions? Comments? What? Yes, in the way back.
Being
He thinks I'm at FedEx sending off an article. This is going to come back to bite me. Yeah. That's where I'm at. I'm 65 years old. Pretty pathetic. I have to be honest.
I haven't told my mom, and it's been 15 years, so we're in a club.
It's hard.
It is hard. It's hard.
Yeah, I've tried to back way off, and we've got a relationship going. I would love to be a relationship of two humans just traipsing the planet, but it's got to be more for him, and yeah, it's difficult. Best wishes, but I think you can kind of back off and do, you know, with family, just kind of not talk about things. It's not great, but it's better than blowing things up, I think.
You know, I've read a little bit of Ray Kurzweil stuff, and I've often thought in the middle of my own faith crisis, in an attempt to be understood, right? Not thinking I'm not crazy, do other people not see this? Like, what the heck's going on? Am I the only person in the room here that's confused by this statement? But I think we've all felt that way, and I've often thought that maybe we won't be able to resolve these things. My hope is that machine learning or a neural link or something will be able to allow us to connect, you know, minds or to enhance our intelligence to a level to transcend some of these inabilities that are, you know, part of our current biological makeup, right? But to me, that feeling of hope. Where can you comment on any of this technology? Do you see that is even possible in, you know, a singularity by 2029? What is that defined by again? That you can pass some big test, right?
That's when software starts writing software and robots build their own robots and humans fall out of the equation. We're no longer needed, right? So maybe we'll get that all figured out in about 10 years when the robots take over. But no, to your point, I do think that, I mean, right now it doesn't look like it, right? Fake news and there's some crazy stuff going on. But I do think that technology will allow us to build better models and get better information. It just doesn't look like it right now. I do think we'll kind of overcome those because we weren't expecting that to happen. I mean, who knew Facebook was going to turn out to be, or, you know, so evil. You read or listen to some of those podcasts and they just went looking for groups. And then they weaponize these groups, right? Little groups that like Kermit the Frog, I think was the example. And then they infiltrate the groups and say, yeah, anybody that likes Kermit the Frog certainly also loves Jesus, right? And therefore doesn't want brown people moving into the United States. And the next thing you know, you got 500 people online that used to just love Kermit, and now they hate a certain class of people. That's been going on. That's really wild and crazy, but I think we'll overcome that. I certainly hope so. There was another comment? No?
That sounds like your communities of practice and knowledge communities, I guess, and being able to subvert them.
I really don't know. It requires the thing that's a little iffy is it requires a lot of education and critical education, stuff that Maizero and Paulo Freire were trying to do. It's like education should be about being able to ascertain the truth, and nowadays it's it's got a long way to go to live up to that. Yeah, but I think we'll do that, and individuals have to kind of do that. The world doesn't work well if people don't have good models of the brain. So I think that's the bottom line. The world just works better if everyone's got a solid model of how the world works. If they don't, things start to fall apart like the robot putting the package on the shelf. All right, we are out of time. I'll hang out if anyone wants to talk longer. Thank you very much for your time.